Evening, Thompson.
G'day, sir.
How are you?
You hate me for this, but I'm eating late.
Gav's not here. It's okay.
Just finished a leg workout, so I'm like frying up a steak.
Nice. Paul, how are you, brother?
Perfectly fine.
Good. How's everything been since you went to camp?
Good as it could be. He's finally feeling
Train
better.
good. Have you upped training? How has everything gone in terms of application since you were there?
Definitely telling my mind it's failing for things like the bench press. Doing better for the leg press, or at least heavier than I did before the camp. And I had a new record for the trap bar deadlift.
Oh, nice. That's great, mate. That's really, really good. Have you got any wins for the last week, except for the new PB and the
No knee pain on squats anymore, so that's fun.
That's massive, though, right? Like, you get out of
Yeah.
pain, man. It just makes training so much more enjoyable.
Yeah.
That's great news. Let's see. We'll ask Thompson in a sec if he's got any wins for us. Any of you guys in the background got any wins for us for the week? No. Thompson, if you're still there, if you're still making your steak, don't worry about
I'm still here, sorry. What was that?
Have you got any wins for the week?
Oh, I was a bit unwell last week, but back into it this week. I've just been refining my kind of run book, daily OS and run book. So
Right.
I was telling Gavin I'm running my life from a spreadsheet right now, so
It's more efficient, man. John, who are you?
I'm just trying to get ready to leave for a rehearsal, but it's
Ah,
been a good
nice.
week.
Good, good. I have to get your video feedback in the morning, so you'll have your feedback on your videos and stuff first thing in the morning. Before I get started, obviously some of you guys I know, what I wanted to talk about today was more based around gut health, the things that we can implement in order to help with it. But first of all, I just want to know if you guys have any symptoms. Jared, we got all of his stool tests and everything back last week. We're able to action all that. But what if any symptoms are you guys struggling with gut health wise at the moment? Mike. Nothing? All perfect digestion. Love it. Let me pull up what we're going to go through. Do. So. When we look at gut health, guys, we first of all, and I'll discuss this as I go through the presentation as well, but we can think of gut health made up of a few different layers to initially start. First and foremost, sympathetics very much determine our ability to be able to digest food. So what I mean by that is, especially since I like speaking to guys, this is all the more prevalent. Sitting and actually spending time in the cephalic phase of eating is really, really important. So we often make food, sit, watch something stressful on television, and wolf our food down. Actually spending time within the cephalic phase of eating. So the cephalic phase of eating is actually the ability to be able to get into rest and digest, but also the ability to be able to, like I said, to calm the nervous system, to smell the food that you're going to eat, to take deep breaths before you actually sit and eat your food, and then actually taking a certain amount of time and allocate a time to eat your food as well at the same. Because I think for a lot of us, we put our, like my wife always says that like eating with me is a sensory delight. Because I tend to just put my face down and not move until the entire meal's gone. Whereas we need to think a little bit more strategically about how we eat our food. So As we start to layer digestion in, we have to think first, what's the state of our body before we eat food? All of our digestive juices are produced and utilized in a parasympathetic tone. So when we are relaxed, we will release more hydrochloric acid, we'll release more digestive enzymes, the gallbladder will contract to release bile. And we'll actually digest and assimilate the food that we're actually eating. Whereas I think for a lot of us, we're in sympathetic tone and we're stressed so much that we're not actually giving ourselves any opportunity in order to digest our food effectively. So I always think that's like number one, and often overlooked by myself, even with my clients, is how is the setting when you eat your food? Do you guys eat at the same desk that you work from? Do you move places? Yeah, I do it as well, Thompson. Like, I'm definitely at fault for this as well. But sometimes you're moving yourself away from the stressful environment and finding an opportunity for you to sit, relax, and eat your food is very beneficial. A lot of people, probably not so much anymore, but a lot of people will watch stressful things when they eat food. So whether they're watching the news or whatever that may be, that can affect sympathetic tone. So that's worth taking into consideration as well. Who here, if any of you guys, have a set eating pattern and way in which you eat? Yeah, Jared, big time. I haven't been on the gym floor for a while, but I remember like doing 12 sessions in a day and 10 sessions in a day, and it is literally the only time you get to eat. Understand, it's just about doing it whenever you have the opportunity. So, does anybody have a set pattern in which they eat their food in? So, like, do you have a setup? Do you have a pre-meal mantra, anything like that? Or is it just make food and eat food? Make food, eat food. There's a couple of things to take into consideration. Have a place that is, like I mentioned, not a stressful environment. So, whether that's just in a different room from where you eat. And I always think before you eat your food, it's 10 deep belly breaths. Okay, you should take a bite of food, chew it thoroughly, and you should put your fork down between every bite to allow time for digestion. And then you need to allocate yourself an entire time for that meal, somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes, generally speaking. And then, if possible, finding the time to walk immediately after meals can really aid in the digestion of it. So they're just a few pretty, they're just a few things you can take into consideration in terms of applications for you guys. And then when we start to layer further than that, so we spoke about like stress environment, how are you eating your food? Then we think about actually the digestion of your food. Do you actually produce enough hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes to fully digest and break down your food? Jared's a good example. He has a little bit of elevated H. pylori, so he actually has low capacity to produce hydrochloric acid. And hydrochloric acid is what's primarily responsible for the initial breakdown within our stomach. So it like denatures proteins. Like, you find a lot of people that have low hydrochloric acid, when they eat meat, they will get gas really quickly after they eat. That's called protein putrefaction. So amino acids are hitting your large intestine where they shouldn't be. So once we've thought about the digestive capacity of it overall, then we can start to think about the integrity of your gut lining. But we'll touch on that when we actually get into some of the presentation. So, what we're going to think about going through today is to understand the different stages of digestion. But more so, I want to think for you guys is that where does gut health go wrong and what can we do to help it? We'll try and make this as applicable for you guys as we can. If you need anything, either just shout out. So throughout this presentation, don't hesitate just to stop me at any stage. If you need clarity, if you want to ask questions on a certain topic or anything that comes up, you can ask questions in the chat as well if you don't want to shout out. So this is kind of what I touched on earlier. We have to first analyze our state beforehand. So we think about the cephalic phase. It's the preparation of food, the relaxation, and the thorough chewing of it to paste. So for most of us, we'll take three bites, we'll chew, 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 swallow, and then we move straight on to the next bite. We need to take the time to actually eat our food so that we can assimilate it and digest it. And then we need to think about stomach and the acidity within our stomach. Anybody here ever suffer from acid reflux? If you have, a lot of people consider acid reflux to be a high stomach acid situation. This isn't always necessarily true. Some people suffer from acid reflux because they actually have low levels of stomach acid. Therefore, sits in the stomach, we get buildup of food within the stomach where it stays for too long, and we get that upwards pressure, which can lead to higher levels. It's much more beneficial to take hydrochloric acid before the meal if you can, John. Now, sometimes it's not always a possibility to take it 10 to 15 minutes prior. Sometimes, you're sitting eating your food, you just think, oh crap, I have to take those. Taking it at any stage is better than not, but generally speaking, beforehand. So we need to understand that stomach acid is the initial stage of digestion where proteins are degraded and denatured, and the initial steps of B12 absorption begins. I see it in so many people who have low levels of stomach acid, and even though they eat lots of red meat, you see they have deficiencies in iron, you see they have deficiencies in B12, even though they would have consumed the food that should give them adequate levels. And you can think about that in a few different ways. So when we look at our ability to absorb food, it's not just the food that we put in our mouth. We have to be able to break that food down. We have to be able to absorb it across the gut lining and then actually to assimilate it within the body. So there's lots of different stages to nutrients and our utilization of them. And like I mentioned, stomach acid is that initial phase. But all of our digestion starts from the top down. So if we have any blockages in any of these phases, the knock-on effects below, or the actions below, will continue to be affected. So for example, if you don't follow some sort of priority with the cephalic phase, you'll release less digestive stomach acid. If you don't release enough stomach acid, that doesn't signal to the small intestine to release enzymes, and then the gallbladder doesn't contract. So we have this top-down effect from the moment we sit to eat our food until we fully digest it. Then we get to the small intestine, where the pancreas will release digestive enzymes. This is important for the further breakdown of your proteins, your carbs, and your fats. And the gallbladder is responsible for fat absorption in the final stage. So we can find issues with clients. We generally see this through stool tests, but we can figure this out through symptoms. One of the major symptoms that you see people with low stomach acid, I just had a client recently who always mentioned bad breath that isn't solved by brushing and flossing teeth. That can be food putrefaction in the stomach because it sits there for too long. When we see small intestinal issues, we can find that people actually really struggle with fiber. So they may not be able to, they know, may not be releasing enough digestive enzymes in order to break down fiber. And then gallbladder is strongly associated with fat absorption. So you see people with reddening of their palms. You see people that get burping when they eat fish oils, or people that just don't respond particularly well to higher fat foods. They can be all issues associated with gallbladder dysfunction. And we can see it's all a top-down effect. So every meal and every time you sit to eat food, you have to think about it in this way. If there is an issue with any of these stages, all the effort that you're putting in to eat the right food, to do the right training, and so on is going to be affected. Now, one of the major ways in which digestion goes wrong, not I say digestion, but gut health in general, is we go through, people suffer with something called leaky gut or intestinal permeability. People often ask, like, why the gut lining is only one cell deep, and they're columnar cells, so they're stacked on top of each other. And they have this ability to become selectively permeable, where they can pull apart to allow nutrients to be absorbed. Or in certain circumstances, if you got exposed to an infection, to allow water to flood into the system to try and wash things out, which anybody who's got gastroenteritis knows what that feeling is like. But when this, because it should be selectively permeable, we are at risk of it becoming chronically permeable and pulling apart. And when that happens, bacteria from the large intestine and small intestine can actually creep into the bloodstream. And this is something called endotoxemia. And endotoxemia is associated with a lot of the issues that we see in the Western world now. It's associated with diabetes, it's associated with cardiovascular disease, and it's strongly associated to mood disorders. So brain fog, fatigue, depression, anxiety. And a lot of the time, the symptoms that we see are a little bit hard to nail down because you'll get unpredictable food reactions. I don't know if any of you guys have ever experienced this. You can eat the same food 3 days in a row, and all of a sudden, on the third time, it gives you some sort of gastrointestinal distress. So maybe you get diarrhea, maybe you get bloating, maybe you get distension. But the number one symptom that people experience from intestinal permeability outside of the gut is joint pain and depression. So that's worth noting. When we have this intestinal permeability, we get this low-grade simmering inflammation that causes symptoms all over the body. So people often complain about wandering joint pain. So one day their shoulder's a little bit sore, the next day their knee's a little bit sore, and so on. Now, one of the ways that, and I can't do this because I don't have you guys in person, another way that you can assess for gut health, you guys might be able to do this if you ever look into the mirror and do it. Checking for, it's not something I discuss here, but checking for something called vagal tone. We have something called a vagus nerve, which comes down from the back of our neck, innervates down through our gut, and then innervates to almost all the organs of the body. And it's this bidirectional highway between the brain and all the other organs. And we can assess this in somebody because the palate at the back of our mouth is strongly controlled by our vagus nerve. So if what you find in a lot of people is they actually have imbalances between left and right brain. So if you ever can look in the mirror, push down your tongue and just go ah, and watch the palates of the back of your mouth. If they don't rise at all, it means you've lost some vagal tone. If one rises more than the other, it means you're losing vagal tone on one side. Just an interesting test for you guys to do on yourselves. Don't worry, we're going to start incorporating this stuff within camps. So you guys will have me looking in your mouths at some stage. But on that topic, value and thoughts on food intolerance tests and our need of removal of foods when rebuilding the gut. It's a really good question, Jared. So the things that you do, it's food intolerance tests are okay. The difficulty that you always come across with something like a food intolerance test is people will flag with all these different ones. So they're like, oh, I'm intolerant to 30 different foods. When people flag like that, they're not actually allergic to all those foods. What it's actually telling you is that you've lost something called immune tolerance. So the immune system in your gut is just so beaten up that it's responding to everything. Now, when we think about food removal, it's going to very much depend on what the problem for a person is. So, generally speaking, if you've got lots of leaky gut, you do want to remove things like gluten, alcohol, dairy to a certain extent can cause issues when people have really high levels of leaky gut. But predominantly, what you want is just a whole food diet. Sometimes people have what's called like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and that needs the removal of FODMAPs. FODMAPs are fermentable carbohydrates that can cause problems for some people, predominantly things like onions and garlic, right? And then in certain circumstances, you need to go full what's called autoimmune paleo. Autoimmune paleo is just, it's like, it's in the name, autoimmunity. But it's very aggressive and very restrictive. Very rare I have to put people on that. Then you can have people who have to go on like low histamine diets depending. So yes, it depends on the problem. So when I think about you, not particularly need to follow a whole food diet and need to most likely remove gluten. So you can see some of the symptoms: increasing frequency of food reactions, unpredictable ones, aches, pains, and swelling, unpredictable abdominal swelling, bloating and distension after eating. And then you can see a lot of the skin issues that people tend to suffer with. So eczema, psoriasis, immune disorders, autoimmune disease, hormonal imbalance, obesity, and fatigue. One of the things that's very common to see in people is rosacea. So where they get that reddening of the skin around the nose, that's strongly associated with leaky gut and also H. pylori. So you, like, this is tricky, right? Because how many people in the world carry a lot of these problems? A lot. Hold on, we got a question. Hives. That's what you're talking about, that in terms of like histamine? Oh, hives in terms of intestinal permeability. Most likely because it's a systemic inflammation response. I don't know directly though. So a lot of these like biofeedback markers aren't perfect anyway. They just give you a general idea of what's going on. And then you can get, so like, what's the cause of a lot of these problems? And it's really, really wide ranging. So I just chucked a few of them in here, like type 2 diabetes, even sleep deprivation, food intolerances, highly processed food. One thing I didn't put in here, like antibiotics can cause it. Certain types of medications, especially NSAIDs. So if you have a history of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory use, they're like little bombs for your gut, and do cause a lot of issues. A general warmth in the face and redness after eating for me. That just could be the thermic effect of the food, possibly, Mike. I wouldn't have thought it's got anything to do directly with like leaky gut or anything like that. That sounds like when, because when we eat, especially but particularly a lot of protein, the energy needed to digest that food is relatively high. So some people will get warmer in those circumstances. Now, sorry, just one more thing. Like some of the stuff that's a little bit more like esoteric, but still true, like environmental toxins, pesticides, things like that can cause issues, or underlying system or underlying gut infections can cause issue a lot of issues with leaky gut. Now, most people will know all about it if they have the traditional infections. So like Salmonella, Giardia, Entamoeba, Histolytica, these things most people will know. But we have these like potentially pathogenic overgrowths like Klebsiella, E. coli, that can cause these problems without being super clear that you have them. Like I had a client, I think I put his before, and he's a muscle intelligence client. I think I put his before and after up on my Instagram, where he had really bad rosacea and eczema on his head, and I didn't have a picture of his body on it, but like also like quite poorly pronounced on his body. He had quite a bad E. coli infection. Nothing else though, and once we managed to clear the E. coli infection and fix the leaky gut, you can see that all his skin issues went away. Now, what's the cure? Like, remove and reduce the underlying cause. If you've got really bad leaky gut and you're drinking regularly, it's going to be hard to out supplement that. It's very similar for using NSAIDs or even stuff like, and I don't always mention it, but like even Accutane or Roaccutane has been shown to cause intestinal permeability in some studies. But I have seen it in quite a few people who have taken it and actually seeing stool tests afterwards that show quite high levels. So certain medications can cause it as well. But dietarily, it's removed the food triggers. So sometimes people just need paleo, sometimes people need low FODMAP, sometimes people need autoimmune paleo, but predominantly you're looking at gluten and dairy as your major triggers in terms of food. And then obviously all the Western food, like, whatever that looks like for you. So really high sugar food. Because like I mentioned on previous, type 2 diabetes is a major predictor. So high levels of blood sugar can cause this problem. It's like you generally see it in obese people that they have some level of leaky gut anyway. And I think sometimes people, when we talk about issues like leaky gut, because it's not so recognized by Western medicine, it is a little bit, it's much more now than it used to be. People just associate it as this like gut-centric problem. So they're like, oh, I've just got a bad gut. People don't recognize the effect of the gut on every other organ. So we have a gut component to chronic kidney disease. We have a gut component, a huge gut component to cirrhosis. We have a gut component to cardiovascular disease and neurodegeneration. So don't just look at it as like, oh, I've got bad guts. It's not affecting me systemically. It is most likely. One of the things, food rotation can be important as well. And then some of the stuff that you can do, like replacing the enzymes, colostrum, glutamine, probiotics, vitamin A, vitamin D, zinc. These things are really, really effective at healing the gut lining. Butyrate actually isn't in here, is it? No. Butyrate is a really, really potent way to heal up your gut lining. Now, has anybody here been diagnosed with leaky gut? Jared, I don't diagnose, but you definitely have leaky gut. No? Okay. John, I think you had it at one stage. I think we got on top of yours. I have to go back through yours, but I'm pretty sure you did. Okay, so let me take you back. Come on. What is going on here? I'll come back to that in a second. I don't know why that's not working for me. Something's gone. Aha, that's probably why. Gotcha. Now, so what else can go wrong? We often hear about like this fancy word of dysbiosis. You just think of dysbiosis as an imbalance between the beneficial bacteria and the non-beneficial bacteria within our gut. There's an argument. So we have just as much bacteria living in us and on us than we have cells in our body. And that gives us indication. It's like we always think that they're hosts, that we are hosts to them. Maybe it's the other way around. So like these guys play wide-ranging roles in our overall health. And it's why I often talk about the importance of fiber. Fiber is the only thing that feeds our beneficial bacteria, and it's something that we often neglect. And most of the time, when I ask people, they can't even tell me how much fiber they have in a day. Now, what can we do in order to increase the beneficial bacteria? We can either supplement with fiber or we can find different types of fiber within our food. Like easy ways to think about it is eating as much a wide variety of fruit and vegetables as possible, incorporating higher fiber seeds and nuts. So like chia seeds, flax seeds, these things can be really beneficial. But some of the symptoms that we see is predominantly, this is when I see really regularly feeling that the bowels don't completely empty. Lower abdominal pain relieved by passing of stool or gas and alternating constipation and diarrhea. They're the most common ones that you tend to see. And you see a lot of the same stuff that you see with leaky gut. So like metabolic syndromes, high blood pressure can be a problem here. Cardiovascular disease, obesity, and hormone imbalances. A lot of our hormones, or some of our hormones, do get activated within our stomach. So testosterone gets made free within our gut. Some of the conversion of our thyroid hormones happen in our gut. So us having beneficial bacteria in there is so important. And it's why, not that I think antibiotics are a bad thing, they're obviously life-saving, but the overprescription of antibiotics are leading to some of these more complex illnesses that you see in people now. So like when you see like the rise in autoimmunity, when you see the rise in even stuff like POTS and all these syndromes, I guess, a lot of those can have strong associations with gut imbalances. So with dysbiosis, it's important to note that the amount of fiber that we eat is super important. Now, there is ways and means that, like, if you have these potentially pathogenic overgrowths, that you have to go after them and kill them. We're not going to go through that today. But one of the things I wanted to give you guys a really clear idea on is that the microbiome has a effect on every other organ within the body. So there's an axis between your intestines and everything else. And we have microbiomes everywhere. Any place we have orifices, so like you can think ears, nose, mouth, gut, anus. For females, they got vaginal microbiome. And all these things are interconnected. So like people think about when they have sinus issues that they don't associate it to the gut. The gut can play a role. And then we can think of the relationship between the gut and the lungs. There's a really strong relationship between people who get upper respiratory infections regularly and who have gut dysbiosis, right? So don't just think of it in isolation. Think about how it feeds and how it reacts with all the other organs in your body. So if we can't figure out a way to get a healthy gut, do we really have a healthy organism? Most likely not. Let's use the liver as a really clear example. You don't drink alcohol, you eat well, but you have certain bacterial overgrowths in the gut. They get direct access to your liver through the portal vein. You don't drink alcohol, so you assume there's no alcohol damage to your gut. That's not true. Certain bacteria within the gut can create aldehydes, which are the end product of alcohol metabolism, which can have direct access. There's something called autobrewery syndrome, which where we produce aldehydes within the body, which make us feel drunk even without the consumption of alcohol. Actually, they don't make you feel drunk, they make you feel hungover. So it's not such a good disease. So understanding that we need to influence this and make sure it's appropriately fed. So what do you need to do with dysbiosis for diet and lifestyle? Everything on the left is good, everything on the right is bad. Okay. So exercise, outdoor activity, normal circadian rhythm, sleep, diverse meals, diverse list of fruit, veg, and fiber, and then diversity within generalized food. You can supplement with fiber also. I do recommend it for a lot of my clients because it's really hard to get high levels from your diet. Now, I don't necessarily follow this rule, but when you look at some of the specialists on the microbiome, they mention 30 different fruit and vegetables a week. How, if you were to count, I'm just going to do it myself, how many different fruits and vegetables do you consume per week on average? So I would normally go, I'm waiting for your answers. So for me, 7 to 10. It's actually not bad. Less than a handful, so not much in terms of diversity. So off the top of my head, I can think about 16 that I do. So even someone who takes it really seriously and I learn about it, I still hit about half. Now, for you guys, I would be thinking at least Brian's hitting it, but at least 10. And incorporating new vegetables within the diet regularly, is it the 5 or the 6 exposure rule? Normally, if you expose yourself to something a certain amount of times, it will improve, or your tolerance of it will improve. So even if there's certain vegetables you don't particularly like, incorporating within the diet regularly will mean that you will learn to like them. So that is my challenge to you guys, is actually looking at the fruit and vegetables that you consume and thinking about how you can expand it so that you can add diversity within your gut. It seems that what's called alpha diversity is the most important marker for gut health. And alpha diversity doesn't mean how much of the good bacteria you have, it's how many species of the good bacteria that you have that seems to determine outcomes. So that's definitely one of the things you want to take into consideration. Now, when you look at some of the bad things, and although I promote this for a lot of clients when they're trying to lose weight, is eating the same meals every day, I generally don't say that for vegetables, right? I'll say it for meat, for consistency, and very similar in terms of the makeup of meals. But changing and adding variety in terms of vegetables, I think, is really important. Sterile environments. So we get exposed to bacteria from the soil, from the trees, from general from outdoors in nature. So living in sterile environments is not good, and it's not good generally speaking for anyone who has kids. It's not good for our kids. The immune system responds to stuff that we get exposed to. Lack of sleep, antibiotics, NSAIDs, pesticides, artificial sweeteners is mixed. So, like for you guys who drink a Coke Zero a few times a week, I'm not asking you to give that up. I do it. But I would say an excessive amount of artificial sweeteners seem to have an effect. And then dysbiosis supplements, short chain fatty acids, PHGG, prebiotics, garlic extract, probiotics, all of these things can be useful. I think I mentioned this the last time we had a conversation. Garlic extract, as long as you can tolerate garlic, is probably a supplement that I think most people can take with a lot of beneficial outcomes, if not just for the gut, but also for your cardiovascular system. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail on some of the infections that we can get. But these are really common to see in people where they get like H. pylori infections. H. pylori is something that is a bacteria that lives in our stomach, and about 50% of the population have it. Doesn't mean 50% are infected, but it can cause issues when it becomes overgrown. And that's the same with SIBO. This is probably the most common reason for IBS. A SIBO is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, where bacteria start to grow in the small intestine where they shouldn't. And when that happens, when we eat some carbohydrates, they ferment in our small intestine, and we get this horrible bloating and distension associated with it. These need slightly more specific approaches if they're going to be dealt with. And some of the symptoms, reflux is really common, bloating, distension, joint pain, cardiovascular disease, constipation, slash diarrhea. So it can be one or t'other, or a combination of both. And this is worth noting, right? So when we look at the reason for your IBS, not that everyone here has IBS, but every once in a while, people will develop IBS-like symptoms. I think it's important to note, like, SIBO seems to be the most prevalent reason. People always think they have parasites. Most people don't have parasites unless you get something really nasty when you travel to India or something like that. But emotional trauma is huge here, because brain dysregulation controls the vagal nerve, and the vagal nerve is responsible for parasympathetic tone, so rest and digest. So some people who have strong emotional traumas who struggle to unravel that can have lifelong digestive problems. So when we look, I think that's down. Yes, that's a different presentation. So when we look at some of the stuff when we suffer with digestive symptoms, People often jump, and I do sometimes as well, jump to supplementation. They need to understand that emotions and sympathetic tone play a huge role in how we respond to food. So, before we start with probiotics, before we start with really aggressive approaches to digestive health, we need to make sure that all the other things are under control first. Then we can start to implement different strategies. Now, it's enough of me talking. In regards to that, has anybody got any particular questions? It doesn't have to be directly about gut health, but just understanding that for you, all of your guys' performance, whether that's in the gym, whether it's your general focus through the day, whether it's overall energy levels, the gut is really central to that. And if there's dysfunction there, it's going to have systemic effects. Any questions, guys? It doesn't necessarily have to be on gut health. So if you guys have any questions on nutrition, mindset to a certain extent, I'm more than happy to answer those as well. We good? Okay. If there's no questions, I'll let you guys go a little bit early. We good? All right. Anyway, thank you guys. Very much appreciated. Have a good Wednesday evening, and I'll speak to you all soon. Thanks, guys.